Adam Klein, Managing Partner, faculty member at New Ventures West, and this is episode 19 of our podcast, Stepping In, a podcast where we delve into how integral coaching can address some of the most pressing issues we face as individuals, communities, and as stewards of our planet. In this episode, I'm in conversation with Bill Burnett, Executive Director of the Design Program at Stanford, where with Dave Evans, he co-founded the Design Your Life program, where students are taught to apply design thinking to the problems of life and vocational wayfinding. He is the co-author of the best-selling book Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life, and the upcoming companion book, Designing Your Work Life. In our conversation, we talk about the origins of the program and how designing your life often entails a different understanding of who we are.
So one of the initial questions I had was, because you guys have been up to this for a while, like what was the original impetus behind starting this? And then what keeps you going and doing it?
Yeah. You know, the origin story is one of those happy accidents. I mean, I'll tell you the literal truth is Dave Evans, who's my co-author and buddy, and we had known each other from some business things beforehand, but we hadn't really worked together. I took this job as the executive director in 2006. I said I'd do it for 10 years. This is 13, but I'm stepping down this year. I'm just going to run the lab and do other things. But so 2006, summer 2006, he comes over and says, hey, let's have lunch. And we had lunch at a little cafe outside the engineering building. And he was like, you know, I'm teaching over at Berkeley, but it's a really long commute from Santa Cruz. Oh, wow. I'll do something with you. Now that you're here at Stanford, we could cook something up. Are your students having a problem kind of figuring out what they want to do when they graduate? I said, oh, yeah, I've been in that office hour for 30 years. You know? And he said, well, maybe we put some, I'm doing this thing over at Berkeley called, something like working on your profession is your calling. Dave is the guy who always comes up with clever phrases. And I said, yeah, let's do it. We'll prototype something this summer. So we got six students together that I knew pretty well, just say, hey, can you spend a couple hours with us on a Wednesday night? We did a Wednesday and a Thursday night, just some very simple exercises, you know, framing your life view, your work view, very early stuff that we were doing. And at the end of the second night, you know, we said, okay, it's 9 o'clock, we're done. And the students went, no, we're not leaving. And we said, no, we really don't have any more stuff. We're done. They said, no, you don't understand. We don't have any place to have this conversation. And we don't have any structure around this conversation. So when we talk to each other, we just get more and more anxious. And this is the first time we've had a real conversation about what we want to do with our lives. And, you know, you got to help us. So we realized there was something there. Now, again, this is a total accident. Dave wanted a shorter commute. I wanted to help students. I thought putting it in a design framework would be useful because I was just going to teach it to my design students. They already know design thinking, so we'll just start there.
Yeah.
We ran that class for about 2 years or 3 years, and then the guy who was running the Career Center came over to us and said, hey, listen, everybody's telling me this class you guys are running about, you know, figuring out your life and finding a job is way better than anything we're doing at the Career Center. Could you scale that for everybody on campus? And I said, no, that would cost, it costs a lot of money. He said, how much? And I gave him a really big number. So he would go away and he said, sure, I'll fund it. So then we started teaching Designing Your Life for all the seniors and got that up to 3/4, you know, 60 kids a quarter, every quarter, you know, maxed out the classroom. And then the vice provost, Harry Ellum, of undergraduate education came and said, hey, I got a bunch of students who are working with me and they tell me your class is the best thing ever. Could you do something for all the freshmen? Because I want the freshmen to really have an engaged experience of college. I don't want them to do it, you know, just rush through it, right? Mm. And we said, no, Harry, that costs a lot of money to do a class for every freshman. That's ridiculous. And he said, okay, how much? And I gave him a big number and he said, sure, let's go. So then we started designing at Stanford about 11 years ago. And then if you do something for the undergraduates, you got to do something for the graduate provost. And at the time, it was a woman named Patty Comfort. She came over and said, I want a class for all the PhD students. So we now do completely, you know, this was a side project that got way out of hand, honestly.
Yeah.
But as Dave describes it, we're kind of the only popsicle stand in the desert. Nobody else is talking about what college is for on this campus.
Yeah.
So we have PhD students, grad students, seniors, and freshmen, and each class has a slightly different focus. But it's really about what's your life going to be about? The big question everybody asks is, will it be meaningful? Will it be interesting? Will I like it? You know, particularly when you're 20, 22, or you're, you know, even a PhD student, you're 28, 29, 30, you're already maybe married, have a kid, and you're finishing up a PhD, and you're like, what is this for? And, you know, if you look back at the history of the university, sort of, you know, I don't know, 80, 100 years ago, the secular universities all decided, hey, we can't talk about meaning, and we can't talk about purpose, what is your education for, because if we do that, we have to pick a framework, and the framework will either be dead white European men or multicultural or something, but, you know, let's just not talk about it.
Yep.
And that keeps us out of trouble. And in fact, we were told when we first started class by a couple people, you know, if you start talking about meaning and purpose, they're going to run you out of town, because you're going to run into the issue of what's the framework of that.
Right.
And I think the reason that hasn't happened, and in fact, it's been quite popular, is that the framework's design. The framework is, you're the designer.
Right.
You have the agency. It's not us. We don't tell you what meaning and purpose is. We don't tell you that these are the five purposeful ways to live your life, and these are the six, you know, meaningful expressions of that life. We just go, okay, let's use design to design. Let's use design tools to design something. We're trying to design this new to the world thing called your future. Well, designers have been doing that for a long time. Most of the classes I teach are in the design program. I teach undergraduate and graduates how to be great designers. And they go on to Google and Facebook and, you know, all these places. I was 7 years at Apple designing the first modern laptops. Dave was one of the founders of Electronic Arts designing, you know, the first video games. So, you know, if you go, look, you're the designer, you decide what's purposeful and meaningful for you, but you use these tools like prototyping and reframing and radical collaboration, storytelling, to go out into the future, this unknown future, prototype a bunch of stuff to see if it's going to work, and then find your way, you know, kind of wayfind or find your way forward with this very emergent creative design process. And so we get around the issue of what's your value system. We do an exercise, write your 250 word or so essay on what is work for? What's your theory of work? Not the job you want, but like, why do we work? What's it about? And then write a 250 word essay on what's the meaning of life, your life view. And I don't care if your life view is, you know, deeply spiritual, agnostic, not sure, you know, human, secular, you know, radical, atheist, you know, Christian, Muslim, Jew, doesn't matter. You have one.
Right.
And when you can match it to what work is for, you experience a coherent life.
Right.
So that's our model, is you're going to design your way into the future. Wherever you start is just fine. It's where you are. And then when you're trying to create this new to the world thing, you know, like a, you know, like an iPhone, then you don't know what an iPhone is when you start.
Right.
They build over 300 prototypes. They showed the iPhone to Steve three times, and three times he said, that's not it, do it again. They right. just kept building until they finally put together enough pieces where the sum was much greater than the parts.
Yep.
And that's how you do your life. Because as far as I know, nobody knows how to predict the future. I mean, some stuff you can plan. You should plan your retirement. You should put money, you know, 10% of your income away every year. And, you know, you can plan, you know, the things that are possible to plan. But don't try to engineer or plan your life, because you don't have the data to do it. So it's an emergent process. It's a design process.
Right.
And that has turned out to be kind of the secret to the reason it works. It's also, frankly, the only thing I know how to teach. So I wasn't probably going to use, you know, stage theory or integral theory or anything else, because that's not my expertise.
Sure, sure. And what has you keep doing this after this happy accident happened? And
well, so, you know, so we scaled a class here, and then about 3-4 years ago, people were starting to say, hey, we want to teach the class somewhere else. So then we created what we call the Transfer Studio, and now we've trained 127 other universities to teach the class. So just knowing that other students get an opportunity to engage this way, and it's at Harvard, Yale, MIT, it's all the Ivies, and it's at a lot of community colleges now, because that's where all the kids are. You know, Stanford's 6,500 undergraduates. It's not very much.
Right.
If you added up all the elites, it's maybe 200,000 kids. But the community college system in California alone is 2.5 million students. The Cal State system is another 650,000 students. So that's where I want to be. I want to be where students are that really don't have any help in finding out this stuff. So that keeps me going. We weren't sure. We had two ideas of getting it off campus. One was teach the other schools. They just come, we charge them like $1,500 for the coffee and donuts and the staffing in the room. So we basically give it away for free. But on the other side, I was like, well, what if I wanted to write a book. I'd never written one. I thought, let's write a book. Maybe we can put this stuff in a book. And Dave was like, yeah, I know. I don't want to write a book. He hates writing. It took me 3 years to convince him to write the book. And then we weren't, you know, and we did the best job we could, and we got a great agent and a great publisher. So that's just been a great source of both joy to know that there's a 500,000 books out there that, you know, 500,000 people are being helped, which is way more than I would ever get to on campus.
Yeah. It's so fascinating. And one of the questions that came up for me when I was like going through the book and looking at other materials is, you know, the book is called Designing Your Life, and it's the orientation around, so we're going to design your life. But it seems to me that there's also inherent in that people are redesigning the understanding of themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could just say a little bit about how you see that and that part of it. So the gateway is let's design your life. And then in the process, it's you're also being redesigned, so to speak.
Yeah, you are. I mean, like you were talking about, you're kind of rewiring your perception of how things are actually working. And one of the reasons the second book is really diving into the world of work is that most people come to the book going, I'm unhappy about something. Mm-hmm. But they don't necessarily want to redesign their life, but the presenting issue is my job sucks, or I'm bored with what's going on, or, you know, this isn't working with my partner, whatever the problem is. And they're looking for some kind of help. Mm-hmm. And what we immediately do is reframe the problem around something that's actually actionable, something you can do something about. And that gets them unstuck, gets them moving. A lot of times people have what psychologists call these dysfunctional beliefs, like, oh, it's too late for me because I picked the wrong career.
Right.
Or, you know, I can't get what I want because, you know, my boss or my company sucks. You know, so they've got a problem. They've decided that the outside world is preventing them from doing something they want to do. And most of the time, it's not true. It's just not true. But they're stuck in a framework that has no solutions in it. Mm-hmm. Because, mm-hmm. It, you know, there actually is sometimes, you're right, your company does suck. And that's just what we call a gravity problem. So let's get right over it and let's work on the stuff we can work on.
Right.
So I think it does. They start with a problem, and then very quickly it zooms back to, well, wait a minute. If we solved this problem, found a better job, found a better town, found a better whatever, you know what's going to happen? If you look at the psychology, there's a thing called the hedonic treadmill. You're just pursuing pleasure and happiness, and then when you get it, it lasts for about 6 months, and then you're going to be unhappy again. And then you're going to want to pursue something else, and then you're going to be unhappy again. So let's get off that treadmill and let's look at what's really going on. And that's where we look at things like the life you work for you and integration. The positive psych guys will say when you know how what you do and what you believe connect, then you're going to experience more meaningful work and life. You have a bigger connection. Well, to do that, I'm going to have to decide what is work for? Is it just for making money? That's fine. You know, this idea that work is supposed to make you happy and, you know, help you find your soulmate and, you know, be your calling in the world, it's kind of a modern idea.
Right.
I'm a second generation. My grandparents came from Germany. Grandfather got the family out of Germany around 33, 34 because he didn't think this Nazi thing was going to go well. But he came to America, didn't speak any English, took a job for 50 cents a day, I think, you know, shoveling shit at the sewage plant. Mm-hmm. Here in Palo Alto. Mm. He wasn't looking for fulfillment.
Right.
He was looking for put a roof over our head, get the family out of Germany, keep people safe.
Yep.
So, you know, Nietzsche had an expression, I can deal with almost any how if I know my why. Mm. His why was, I want to put a roof over our head to keep us safe. not I'm looking for fulfillment in my work.
Right.
So you start unpacking this stuff. What's real work really about? Is it just for money? Is it for money and meaning? Okay, if it's for meaning, what's meaning all about? Well, it's connected to my life field. We have a new tool in the new book I call the maker mix, because everybody's a maker nowadays. And, you know, but people get confused. Like in the work economy, you make money. You exchange money for your labor. In the nonprofit economy, you get impact. You measure, you don't, you in the money economy, you measure how much do I make.
Right.
In the nonprofit economy, you measure impact. How many kids are in my after school program so they're not going into gangs, so they're gonna go to high school and they're gonna finish and they're gonna go to college. That's my impact. And then everybody wants to be more creative. In every Odyssey plan we've ever seen, there's always that, yeah, I wish my life was a little more creative. I had a little more something. So you go talk to the artist and say, well, how do you get paid? And they go, we get paid in expression. Expression is our dollars. If I get a chance to paint my painting, I get a chance to read my poem, I get a chance to perform my play, I'm a happy maker. So there's really three currencies: money, impact, and expression. And once you break it down, you go, oh, I see why I'm unhappy. It's not I thought it was I wasn't getting enough money. It's not, I have enough money. Most people have enough money in most cases. And more, and the psychology of more tells us past a certain point, more money isn't going to matter at all.
Right.
But where's your impact? Are you underinvesting in impact, you know, dollars? Are you underinvesting in expression dollars? So we give people these little tools, and it does really rewire their understanding. So they're the exact same person. They're looking at the world with the mindset of the designers, and they're seeing possibilities instead of limits. And then they're prototyping, they're just trying stuff into those possibilities, and they get moving, and they don't feel stuck. And life is an emergent reality, and you just keep doing it until you die. So there's no end to the design.
Yep.
But there are points where you've optimized what's working for you. And you can, and if I asked you, how's it going? You could say, you know, it's going pretty good. I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm getting paid in the currencies I want to get paid in, impact, expression, and money. And I've got the right balance. And yeah, I can make it better, but I don't feel stuck anymore.
Yep.
And so that's the secret, right? Is to get unstuck. And I tell my designers when I'm teaching design, hey, you're going to get all these problems you've never gotten before. That's the whole thing about design. Design an iPhone. Okay, now design. I was a consultant for 10 years. Design a toilet. Okay, now design an iPhone. Okay, now design a chip that does, you know, HD TV. It's like, okay, I've never done this before, but I got a process. I know how to do it. And you jump in and you do it. So if you have a process for this emerging life, you feel like you're in control. You feel like you're the agent. And you're also willing to, you know, like half of my good ideas, like DOL, were just an accident.
Right.
But I was available. I was ready for it. I was listening. I was listening to the universe. Like, hey, what's going on, universe?
Yep. Yep.
There's a great Tony Hsieh video. He's the founder of Zappos. And he has this thing about music in class about getting good at being lucky. Because he had a thing when you applied to Zappos, you had to answer the question, are you lucky or not? You know?
Yep.
And it was based on a piece of research where they asked people to rate themselves lucky or unlucky. 1, 2, 3, I'm not very lucky. 9, 10, 7, 8, 9, 10, I'm very lucky. I don't know why. Good things always happen. So that was the rating scale. And then they had people read a newspaper and count the number of headlines or the number of pictures in the newspaper. And as you know, every psych experiment, whatever they ask you to do, that's not the experiment.
Right.
So it was a fake newspaper, looked just like a real New York Times or something, you know, 20-page, you know, front section of the Times. And buried inside the text of the articles was a little piece of text that said, hey, if you read this, the experiment's over, collect an extra $150. So the data was people who rated themselves as unlucky did the task, read the newspaper, got the right number of photos or headlines or whatever they were supposed to count. They nailed it. They got their $100. Thank you very much. The people who were rated themselves as very lucky, 80% of the time, found the other piece of text, quit early, and made an extra $150. And so the conclusion of the psychologist was, it's not about being lucky or not. It's just about being like available and open and like looking at something other than the task that you were told to do. You have your peripheral vision open and you're paying attention to the universe.
Yeah.
And sometimes the universe throws you a little piece of text that says, hey, you want an extra $150? You're done.
Yeah, right.
Or sends Dave over to my office because he doesn't want to commute to Santa Cruz. Or, you know, a friend of mine calls a friend of mine and he says, hey, we're starting a new consulting company. I heard you're bored at Apple. You interested in checking this out? You know, so it's just being available. But to be available, you have to be in a creative mindset. You have to be looking for more than just what's right in front of you. And you can't be stuck.
Yeah. Yes, that's what leads me to one of the other questions I had is in the end of the book, you mentioned having life practices are important. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you see those correlating to what you're just talking about staying open, about being, you know, kind of paying attention and also having the, what I would call sort of fluidity orientation to life and flexibility. So there's not a lot of rigidity there. So what's your sense of how those get built and those capacities get built for us?
Well, that's why we talk about them as practices, because they are practices. Dave would say it's kind of the aerobic practice of awareness, right? Like, do you have a mindfulness practice? Do you have a journaling practice? We have a thing called the Good Time Journal, which is based on the simple positive psych that says if at the end of every day you write down one or two things you're grateful for, you will start experiencing your life as more wonderful. Yeah. And it can be as simple as, oh, the lady at Starbucks smiled when she handed me the latte, or the checker, you know, at the supermarket noticed I dropped my dollar. And she said, hey, you dropped a dollar. So little tiny things like that. So, but you need those practices because when you want to make a really good decision about a really hard problem, I got two job offers and I don't know which one to pick. I've got, I'm dating this person, but I don't know if this is going to go anywhere or not. Right. When you come up to the big questions in life, you'd really like to have a little bit of talent in introspection. You want to have developed that introspection muscle. Mm-hmm. Because it's really clear from the neuroscience that you cannot make a good decision if you don't have, you haven't developed your emotional intelligence, your social and emotional intelligence are critical to making good decisions, at least good decisions that work in your life. And so you don't want to come across a big decision. That'll happen, you know, many, many points in your life and not really know how you feel. Mm-hmm. And we're in such a busy society right now, in such a distracted society right now. That I run a really simple exercise in my class, the very first day of class, in my design classes. I actually do it in Designing Your Life too. It's just a little puzzle and it's really hard to solve and everybody fails. At least the first round they all fail because the way they're trying to solve it, you can't solve it. And I go around the room and I say, who got stuck? And everybody raises their hand. I said, when you felt stuck, where in your body did you feel it? And most of the students are pretty inarticulate. They don't know where they felt it. With a little bit of prompting, it'll be like, yeah, I got this sick feeling in my stomach, or I felt like I was choking, or my head went numb and I couldn't think. But those are really different.
Right.
Your gut is connected to the emotional center of your brain. You know, not being able to breathe, that's a fight, flight, or freeze response.
Right.
So you want to know what's happening in your body and you want to know your feelings. So practices like journaling, mindfulness, writing yourself a letter to yourself from the future. We have a bunch of them, if you have a spiritual practice, awesome. If you don't have that, you could substitute with, mindfulness is just meditation rebranded, which is just prayer rebranded. And depending on which version of you are, you can pick any name for that. But you need to spend some time with yourself to know how you feel. Because this chatty part of your brain is talking all the time. And it's also, and in that brain, there's your dad talking and your mom talking and your friends talking and everybody talking. And you don't even know what you think.
Right.
And I'm finding this is more and more and more with my Gen Zs now and my other students.
That was another question I had is what you're seeing.
In such a distracted world that they don't know how they feel. When I ask them, I'll say, how do you feel? And then they'll tell me the pros and cons of a decision. I said, that's not what I asked. I asked for an emotion and you gave me facts. Now tell me how you feel. And they really will struggle other than I don't know what I feel or I feel kind of numb. So even numb is okay. It's like numb means I'm looking for a feeling that I can't find it.
Right.
But at least I've got numb. I mean, that's something.
Right.
Below that is typically some fear. Below that is typically some emotions that we can actually use to make a good decision. But boy, if you don't practice, particularly in our distracted society, you're going to not have access to really critical information when you try to make a hard decision.
Yeah. Well, and what I'm thinking about is not having access to our humanity, which if you're in a human-centered design.
Exactly.
You can't be a good designer. Right. If your humanity isn't available to you, you're very limited.
Well, our process starts with empathy. So empathy requires you to feel what the other person is feeling there and then name it so we can actually design with it. Therefore, if you don't have any feelings or any feelings, everybody, of course, has feelings, but they've suppressed them or they've numbed them out or they've mislabeled them. But if you don't have access to them and you can't use that information, you can't be a good designer.
Right.
But by the way, it's a pretty common experience after people take we have a deep dive on what we call need finding, which is the class on empathy and human-centered design research. About halfway through that class, a bunch of kids will show up in my office hours and they'll just burst into tears. Mm. And they'll go, I was working on this problem and I was trying to understand what these people were doing. And these kids over, let's say, at the hospital with cancer or something. And then I realized how much I felt, how many emotions were coming up for me in just doing these interviews. And then I realized, you know, how that was making me feel. And then I was questioning my own mortality. And then they burst into tears. And I go,
right.
And then they're very embarrassed. And I say, you know what? If a designer can't cry over a problem they're working on, they're not a good designer.
Right.
So it's okay. And it's probably the first time you've had these feelings. And guess what? This is going to show up in other places in your life. Right. Have you noticed that your partner sometimes thinks you're unavailable or thinks that you want to rationalize all of the answers to the problem instead of talking about how they make you feel?
Right.
Oh, yeah, that comes up a lot of times with my partner.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Got to be a whole live human being to be a designer.
And one of the things I was also curious about in your work in design class and in this designing your life, how you support students when they face disruptions, like things don't go as expected or they run into something that throws them off. And how are you working with their resilience in those moments as they show up?
Yeah. You know, and it's like two pieces of sort of research we always draw on. One is obviously Angela Duckworth's book on grit and sort of the grit scale and how grit predicts success more than IQ and everything else. And also, you know, kind of there's a guy over in a researcher who we really love, Bill Damon. He's over in what's called the Center for the Study of Adolescence at Stanford. And I think Bill's going to go emeritus pretty soon, but he's been a big researcher in the area of, you know, young adult development. He divides in his research in a book he called Path to Purpose. He divides the population that he's been studying into four categories: the dabblers, the dreamers, the purposeful, and the broken. Broken are just, you know, adolescents who had some kind of abuse in their life or neglectful parents, and until that's fixed, they can't do anything. Mm-hmm. The purposeful, and it's only 20%, you know, have like, I know what I want to do. I've always wanted to be a doctor. I've always wanted to be a ballerina. I've always wanted to be an astronaut. And they just go for it. And it's clear for them that this is the path. But 60 or 70% in the middle are what he calls dabblers and dreamers. Dreamers are like, I want to work on climate change. I'm going to solve climate change. But actually nothing I can do between now and next week has any, you know, impact on the problem. So they have these big problems, but they have no way of actually addressing them.
Yeah.
That's the dreamers. And the dabblers are like, this week it's climate change. Next week it's sex trafficking. Next week it's, you know, I want to learn to code. The next week it's something. It's like they have lots of different things. They try lots of different things, but there's no connection. You know, it's not progressing towards something. And so most of the time when kids come in and they're stuck, it's one of those things. First of all, it's we've got a pretty overparented group of young students. I think the parents have really tried to protect them too much, so they haven't developed a lot of grittiness in some cases. And in a lot of cases, I mean, they're really energetic and they're smart and they're well-meaning, but they aren't connecting the dots. One of the questions we hate is, what's your passion? Because all the research says less than 20% of people have it, and most of you get it after you worked really hard at something and then you discover that's your passion. So it's not a starting point, it's a little more of an end point. But it's the stupid question everybody gets asked, because like, oh, if you could just tell me your passion, of course the world would pay you handsomely for that and everything would be just perfectly organized. So if you have one, great, but most people don't. And so then the question is, what's the hard work I got to do to figure out, what's my mission? And my mission for now, most of my students, all the research says they're going to have three completely different careers anyway.
Right.
They might live to be a healthy 100, which means they're going to work for 60 years.
Right.
So I hope they're going to have, more than one thing to do. And I always tell them, do you really want your 22-year-old telling your 45-year-old what he's going to do for a living? You think that's a good idea? Like, it's just for what you're going to do for now. But when you can connect it to your life view and your work view, when you can connect it to your reflections that come from a practice like mindfulness, you kind of know what fits and what doesn't. And you know it in a different way than your pro-con list, which you have that too, right? Because you need facts to make a good decision. But you can't get a lot of facts about the future, so it has to come from multiple ways of knowing. We call discernment, how to discern what's right for you. Knowing with more than one way of knowing. And again, in our society, we highly overrate cognitive, fact-based knowing, as if we could put everything on a spreadsheet and that would just tell us an answer.
Yep.
Gives us a direction, but it doesn't necessarily tell us an answer. And if we bring people into class, we call them mentor visitors, who've had kind of interesting, careers and stuff that the students would go, oh, well, that's cool. I want to be like that guy, that girl.
Yep, yep.
And we say, tell your story, but tell the truth and tell it from where you were when you were 20 to where you are today. Because I guarantee you, when the students hear the real story, well, I was 22, about your age, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I tried this. I basically failed at almost everything I tried. Then this guy called me up and said, you want to do this? And I did that for a little while. I really kind of liked it. So I doubled down on that and I went to this. And then I decided to go back to grad school. And then, did it. And like, it's a wandering path.
Yep.
Just start with, oh, Billy, you're a professor at Stanford and you teach this class, it must be great. It's like, yeah, but I know how I got here. But boy, everybody else cleans up the story. Yeah, I'm a very experienced venture capitalist and I make a lot of money because I'm smart and I did the right thing and I went to Harvard.
Right.
Like, it's not true. It's almost never true. Very few people, knew what they wanted to do at 8 years old and are doing it.
Right, right.
And liking it. I meet a lot of people who are really unhappy doctors and really unhappy lawyers. Who are very successful and making lots of money and just don't like what they're doing and did it because that's what they thought they wanted to be when they were 10.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now they're stuck. Yeah. Everybody gets stuck in their own special way. And if you're stuck, if you're stuck, just as you're making $2 million a year and you have a nice house in Manhattan, if you're stuck, you're stuck. You feel bad. You feel just as bad. As somebody with a high school education trying to get a better job, so everybody's pain is real.
Yeah, yeah. And what's your way in with people when you are working with them and they're stuck? Where do you start?
It basically just like, well, what are the assumptions behind this thing that you say you can't have or you can't do or you can't there's a big sign over the loft and it's on the inside cover of the book. It says, you are here. And one of the students put that up a while back. And it's just like, okay, we start from where we are. We start in reality. We start with what's the problem. Nobody buys the book unless they think they're going to solve some kind of a problem. So what's your problem? Well, I don't like my job. I don't like my, I got to go back to school. I don't have the money, but whatever the problem is. And we unpack that a little bit, try and get people to do a little reflection, and then reframe it. Because a lot of times, you know, we have this thing we call an anchor problem, where you've there's only one solution to my problem. If I can't have that, so the anchor problem is, Dave's anchor problem was, I want to go sailing every weekend, but I can't afford a boat and I can't afford a slip. And there's a 10 year waiting, list to get a slip in Santa Cruz. So I can't sail.
Yeah.
It's like, well, wait a minute. If the goal is sailing every weekend, owning a boat is one solution, but it's one of a half a dozen solutions that will allow you to sail everything. So unpack the problem, reframe it, and then start prototyping forward. And it can be really simple. It can be a very small thing. But once people make at least a little bit, I mean, in the second book, our secret method is set the bar low.
Well, that's what I'm hearing.
Set the bar low. Everybody's trying to do too much. You're trying to
do 90%
of New Year's resolutions fail in 60 days because people are like, hey, I'm going to run a marathon this year. Yeah, I'm going to get fit. I'm going to run a marathon. I'm like, give me your phone. You're not even doing 5,000 steps. Dude, between here and a marathon is a year's worth of hard work.
Right.
So let's break it into smaller steps. Let's see if we can get to 5,000 steps for 2 weeks. Now let's get to 10,000 steps for 2 weeks. You got to start small because you'll defeat yourself.
Right. That's what I'm appreciating about what you're saying is bringing people back into here's where you are. Here's what's the current state of your life, and here's some incremental things that we can work with.
Right,
and building something, and have some wins.
Some wins, and those are prototypes, and the prototypes give you a felt experience of winning.
Right.
Hey, and a prototype can just be, I don't know anything about coaching, and I'm really curious about what you guys do, and I call you up and say, hey, can I have 30 minutes of your time and buy you a cup of coffee and tell me about coaching in the coaching world and how you got into this? We have something in common. I looked you up on LinkedIn, and I think you're really cool. I bet you think you're really cool. Can I get 30 minutes of your time for a cup of coffee? That's time travel. I've now discovered a person who could be me and exactly what I would look like in the future if I was going to pursue this path. Right. That's a prototype. Hanging out with some coaches is a prototype.
Right.
Doing what we call a moccasin walk. Spending a day with somebody, shadowing somebody for a day is a prototype. And they're always of learning, getting this felt experience. But the felt experience only works if at the end of the, and when you come back from that experience, and I say, how did it make you feel? Not what did you do?
Yes, back to the feeling.
You need an answer.
Right.
Yeah, set the bar low. It's a secret. It's been a secret in my life.
Thank you for joining us. And I hope you enjoyed this episode of Stepping In. Please spread the news by sharing this podcast on social media and letting us know what you think by emailing us at steppingin@newventureswest.com. Until next time, take care.